Good morning. This is Saturday Morning Live, and you're listening to Radio Regent. My name is Mally, aka DocuVixen. We're heard here every Saturday morning, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and we go right to Mamiya Abu Jamal.
State of Disunion 2014. I have seen many State of the Union addresses, events of pomp and ceremony, of glad handing and fake smiles from President Jimmy Carter to the present president, Barack Obama. The Constitution doesn't so much require it as it barely mentions it. In one lonely line, Article 2, Section 3 states, the president shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. There's more, but not much. He could send a note, but where's the fun in that? And so these events have become annual gatherings, food to journalists and manna to speechwriters. It's been a Hollywood set from which to launch wars on drugs, on poverty, on Iraq, and on Afghanistan. But it's not a place for unity, particularly when it comes to President Barack Obama. It's been a state of disunion, where the House of Representatives has set its face against the man in all of his attempts to govern. As a direct consequence of such intransigence, the president has been forced to utilize his powers of executive order, even though he has used it less than any other modern president. It matters little that this is perhaps the most unpopular Congress since the Civil War. The reorganization of voting districts has made them virtually invulnerable. Why worry about national polls when you're guaranteed to get reelected? Obama pulled off political miracles when he got elected and then re-elected. But elections are one thing, governing is another. You can call it a State of the Union address, but without unity, it's simply an address, words. The shadow of the Civil War still lies low over a nation called the United States. Owning the world. Several days ago, a press report surfaced that was among the most outstanding I've ever seen. The headline bore a curious equation. 85 equals 3.5 billion. At first, it made no sense until I read the body of the article. It explained 85 people had wealth and assets equal to 3.5 billion people the world over. I had to reread it. 85 individuals had personal wealth equal to 3.5 billion people, or half the world. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that unbelievable? Isn't that astonishing? If ever we doubted how unequally wealth is distributed in the world, along comes this fact. If the Occupy movement hadn't been beaten back into the shadows, their remarkable call, "We are the 99%," or "Down with the 1%, would have to be revisited. For instead of 1%, it'd be 1/100 of 1%. 85 people, maybe 1/1000th. Rome, infamous for its rich and corrupt Senate, never saw such inequality as this. Marx, for all of his acumen, never saw this coming. This vast wealth is especially obscene in an era of austerity, when budgets are cut, schools are closed, and prisons experience population booms. The politicians who serve this tiny, wealthy class cut more and more as Congress fills its own ranks with more and more millionaires. They are those who scream, "No new taxes," on the wealthiest people in the world. IRS at war with Pastors for Peace. The Reverend Lucius Walker, the leader of the IFCO group, Pastors for Peace, is no longer among us. He worked for many years in solidarity projects with the embattled people of Cuba and Palestine. He is gone. But IFCO, Pastors for Peace, are still with us and still working to be a presence of peace in places that seem to be itching for war. At the behest of right-wing hate groups, now the IRS is on the attack. That's because the far right hates any group which doesn't support their imperial vision and works to put Americans in touch with the people of the world, no matter where they are. And now that the IRS has been criticized by the right, it seems like they're now taking on left and anti-imperial groups like IFCO, Pastors for Peace. IFCO, the first national foundation controlled by people of color in the U.S., is now targeted by the government to strip it of its tax-exempt status. Amazing. It's been active in the struggles for global peace for nearly half a century, making friends between Americans and other nations. When Reverend Lucius Walker was alive, he brought thousands of American young people to Cuba to learn and to practice solidarity. That good human work is being threatened today, and only you can help. Remember, an attack on IFCO, Pastors for Peace, is more than an attack on one group. It's an attack on the human and constitutional rights of Americans to speak out, to dissent, to travel, and to practice one's faith. The late Reverend Lucius Walker led Pastors for Peace because he was moved by the message of St. Matthew 25:35 in the New Testament. For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Help IFCO, Pastors for Peace, continue their work by contacting Congress members to demand that IRS cease this harassment against IFCO, Pastors for Peace. Contact the Treasury Department to demand that the political persecution of IFCO be stopped. Support IFCO, Pastors for Peace, by donations to fight against this political attack at IFCO News, IFCONews.org, or call 212-926-5757, or send a check to IFCO, IFCO, at 418 West 145th Street, New York, New York, 10031. Help keep Reverend Lucius Walker's dream of world peace and global solidarity alive.
We at Law & Disorder have kept you updated on his case for the 10 years we've been broadcasting. It is now our pleasure to welcome Mumia Abu-Jamal as our special guest. Professor Johanna Fernandez joins us in the studio as Mumia calls from State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy, in Frackville, Pennsylvania. Johanna is a professor of history at Baruch College and co-coordinator of the newly launched campaign to bring Mumia home. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm here with Johanna.
Hey.
Hi, Mooster.
Hi, Mooster. Last week, we had rather extraordinary news. Five of the eight Media Pennsylvania FBI activist burglars came forth with their identities. Mumia, what were you doing in 1971? Who were you, and what did your world look like?
I remember with quite a degree of distinction receiving in the mail a packet full of Xeroxed FBI files. I believe by 1971 I had left the party. And so this was like a double triple, a blockbuster. I sat and I read through files that really named names and detailed internal affairs of the Black Panther Party of Philadelphia, the national office, other organizations, activists all throughout the city and the region. And it was a mind blower, again, especially. Imagine reading about someone that you lived with as a comrade, as a brother in an organization. You know, for what that means is for members of the party, we lived in communal apartments and houses. We lived together, we worked out of the same office, and we spent all day together with each other. And to read about lies that were in those files, and then people that you knew for years who were FBI informants and stuff like that, it was absolutely mind-blowing. But it proved everything that we thought, and it kind of confirmed every suspicion, you know. And it was a different world. So to see this, the news, right, from Media Pennsylvania, it's quite refreshing and amazing in many respects that these people held that secret for over 40 years.
Do you think they came forth because of the changing attention to NSA surveillance, Ed Snowden, the other whistleblowers who've come forward?
I think they are the linear ancestors of Edward Snowden. You know, back in those days, you had to find paper, right? Not emails or electronic messages. But these were anti-war people, for the most part, living their own lives, but also wanting to make a contribution, right, to the movement, because they were part of the movement. They were part of the anti-war movement. When we talk about Media Pennsylvania, most of us, unless you're of a certain age, it doesn't ring a bell to you, right? Those files that were ripped off from the media offices of the FBI showed that every organization of any kind of notoriety, actors, artists, women's groups, all kinds of organizations were followed by the FBI, you know, for really practicing their constitutional rights. It was mind-blowing, and I remember very, very well. After that, I think that is the one thing that made the Church Commission hearings possible. And it really exposed what was happening all across the country. It's interesting that these files come out now because, you know, for someone who's been reading and writing recently about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., people know now that the FBI taped hotel rooms where Martin and Ralph David Abernathy and other civil rights activists, you know, were staying, and taped office and phone calls and that kind of stuff. Well, they tried to use those tapes to blackmail Martin King and actually force him into suicide. This was all part of Hoover's plan to destroy the Black Freedom Movement and any movement that was against what the government was doing. Any dissenting movement.
Why did you get a copy of those documents? Were you working in Philadelphia as a journalist at the time?
It's entirely possible that I did get those because I was doing some radio work. But it's also possible that people saw my name in it and sent it to me. I mean, I remember getting it and it had like no return address, something like Citizens Committee or something like that. And then, of course, the anti-war magazine put out by a group called the Philadelphia Resistance, they had a magazine called When, I believe. They republished those documents, put them in kind of real neat form, and they sent them around to an additional group of activists and journalists. So if you were part of the movement or involved in journalism, you got a packet in the mail. You may not have known where it came from, but once you cracked it and read it, boy.
What's fascinating to me as an historian is that in 1971, we know that there was a crisis of legitimacy in government. Americans had lost faith and hope and trust in their government as a result of the Vietnam War, but also the radicalization of the movements. But
this
today,
call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
But today, we are operating in a completely different political atmosphere. And what we see is that Americans are easily tricked into buying the government line that we need to give up our civil liberties and allow broad surveillance of citizens in the name of national security.
Well, I don't think it's literally in the name of national security. Of course, they use those words. You know, the government uses national security to disguise everything. But I think that we can't have this discussion intelligently unless we consider the psychological and then the political impact of 9/11. You know, Bush used to go around saying 9/11 changed everything. It sounded crazy, but there's a certain truth to it. It did change the temperature of America. It did change the psychosis, right? And it reflected the very deep insecurity and fear and paranoia among Americans. So I remember Bush saying stuff like, well,
you don't do what I say, the terrorists win. You know, that kind of stuff. Now we can look back and see that all of that was pure BS. But you couldn't see it on 9/11 or the days and weeks and really years following. It's interesting that Law and Disorder is talking about 9/11 when right there in New York you have an estimated 100 cops who use 9/11 to justify scamming the public. Cops, prison guards, and a few firefighters. You know, they would get disability. And they're running around, you know, bicycling or, you know, teaching martial arts, really living high on the hog of the New York and the federal budget. But it gives you a sense of how deeply 9/11 really did change the consciousness of millions of Americans. I think it's changing, but, you know.
We'd like to finish by talking about ordinary heroes. Recently, photographer John Dominus, who snapped the shot of the 1968 Black Power salute with John Carlos and Tommy Smith, died. Actress Juanita Moore, known by many for her role in Imitation of Life, died. Who are your ordinary heroes? I'm not saying they were ordinary people. They were extraordinary, but give us...
That's a real great question. You know what? When you think about the ordinary heroes, these are people whose names are not known. You know, we can talk about Martin King. We can even talk about, like, Huey P. Newton. But what would they be? And would their names be known to us without the everyday activists, right, who join movements to push them forward? For Martin's case, it was church women for the most part. I mean, think about the Baptist Church. Probably 70% of its population are women and black women.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
You know, those nameless black mothers and grandmothers, sisters and daughters, they made that movement possible. So they're my heroes. And black people across the country who, sisters again, whose names we don't know for the most part, like Frankie Malika Adams from the Brooklyn chapter, Sister Love from the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. Those sisters came out at great danger to themselves and built the Black Panther Party essentially from the ground up. So, you know, we remember the famous brothers, we remember the names of the brothers, but how many of us remember the work and the sacrifice of the sisters who got it done, who made it possible?
Wow. Mumia, what was interesting to hear about the seven who broke into the FBI office was that they were ordinary people who took action because they were not able to live with their conscience anymore. I think that's important because we tend to think that society is changed by incredibly brave, out of the ordinary human beings. But when we look at history, it's ordinary people who change history who were driven by their moral conscience.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the proverbial head, because to look at them now, I mean, people perhaps in their 60s and 70s, these are the most average people in the world. But they're average people who felt two things. That the protests, right, carrying signs and, you know, camping and marching around the Pentagon, you know, sending a letter to the editor was not enough. And they resolved on their own. I mean, I've always wondered who these people were. I never knew, obviously. They resolved on their own, right, to take an action that really had historic transformation in terms of democracy and showing people what the government was doing. Even if you think of Edward Snowden, he's really quite an average guy. No college education to speak of. He's just like a computer whiz. Now, he got a great job, and he resolved in his mind, in his heart, in his soul, that he would not be silent about the things he saw and heard. And while it's too early to say history has been changed, I think we all can agree his revelations and the stuff he's released has had a profound impact, not just on American society or American politics, but you've got people in Brazil, people in India, people in Germany, and people in France, and people in England talking about it. That's pretty remarkable. That's one man.
There's a whole lot of disorder, however, in his actions. He broke the law, as did the seven who broke in. What are your thoughts?
Indeed, that is true. And the media people waited until the statute of limitations, but also the political temperature change. I think, like I said, that Snowden had an impact on them. You know, Martin King said that there are laws that need to be broken because some laws are fundamentally unjust. Laws should serve men, not men serve laws.
It's so good to hear your voice.
30 seconds remaining.
At the 30-second countdown, we want to say we love you.
We love you. And we're going to bring you home.
That's
yes.
That's what I'm talking about. Thank
home
both of
soon.
Y'all. Let's continue making law and disorder. On a move.
On a move.
Another great visit with Mumia.
It's humbling to know that the United States can incarcerate one of the most important public intellectuals of our time. That interview is a really beautiful display of both Mumia's intellect and his understanding of history, but also of his humanity. It's chilling to hear those words in the context of the noise in the background. He's behind bars in prison, and what you hear, the hundreds of other men who are warehoused at SCI Mahanoy.
Johanna, we have some exciting news to share with our listeners, and that is a new campaign. You've been very active in helping pull this together with hundreds of other individuals. It's called Bring Mumia Home. Tell us about it.
So the campaign to bring Mumia home is a formation that emerges in this new period when Mumia is out of death row. And what's interesting, Heidi, is that many people thought that after Mumia was released from death row, the movement would quiet down. But what we've seen is, in fact, the opposite. And the campaign to bring Mumia home has drawn to the movement a new generation of activists who came of age after the 1990s, when there was a massive international movement coalescing to save Mumia's life and to keep the state from executing him. So these young people are now being introduced to this phenomenal human being whose story of resistance against the state has captured their imagination. The campaign to bring Mumia home is bringing together the different currents within the movement to free Mumia. And of course, that movement has been long led by PAM Africa of the International Concern, Friends and Family of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and other important people with this new cohort. And we are in the process of thinking through a political strategy that's going to mainstream Mumia, but also break open ground zero in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that's Philadelphia, where the Fraternal Order of Police has ideological hegemonic power, right? They have an enormous amount of influence in Philadelphia, but we are going to ground zero, and we're launching a campaign that is going to mainstream Mumia in Philadelphia, and we've begun so quickly. We got coverage on December 9th in Philadelphia. December 9th, as your listeners know, marked the 32nd year of Mumia's incarceration. And every year, the movement holds some kind of event. And we held a press conference. We also had a series of other activities with young people. We even had a series of yoga sessions titled Free Your Mind, Free Mumia, Free Them All. And we got coverage in the Philly Weekly.
What's the website? I know Mumia's 60th birthday is coming up in April. It's going to be on us soon, and I understand there are actions planned about that, but I think the coordinating website is an important place for our listeners to check out.
Minutes after midnight on New Year, our incredible website went live. You must check it out. It's bringmumiahome.com.
Bringmumiahome.com.
I want to instruct your listeners to turn up the music when you go to the website. And just a little story, we were in the midst of pulling it all together. We were very excited. A lot of the young people who are now part of the movement helped us build the site. And we asked Mumia, we know that you've never seen the World Wide Web, and you know not what a website looks like, but if you had to imagine something on a website, what would it be? And he said, music. And so we've added music to the website, and it's quite beautiful, and it's quite powerful.
If anyone listening to us would like to join the campaign to bring Mumia home, email bringmumiahome@gmail.com and be sure to mention that you heard about it on Law and Disorder. Professor Johanna Fernandez, thank you so much for all that you've done in Mumia's case and to draw attention to political prisoners around the globe, really, and for joining us in this wonderful interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Thank you so very much for your work on Law and Disorder. And before I go, I should tell you that I visit a prisoner in New Jersey who told me that he listens to Law and Disorder from prison. So the work you do really touches the hearts of people who really need to hear that there are people who are on the right side of justice.
Thank you. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs.
Dennis. For former NBA star Dennis Rodman, the world may seem to be at war with him, but it is not. For the media is hardly the world, and the world is hardly the media. It is the private property of the wealthy and the tool of the state. And this is especially so when its target is a black person. For daring to visit North Korea, Rodman has been subjected to ridicule and baited by journalists who have no right to ask him to perform a service for which he's not been trained. For Rodman isn't a diplomat. He's one hell of a basketball player. Isn't it strange that the U.S. State Department has no real influence in the country, and the retired basketball player does? Or that the nation with more prisoners than any nation on earth dares complain about one American prisoner? Rodman has nothing to apologize for. The U.S. complains about Korea's political prisoners. What about Leonard Peltier, the Move 9, the Cuban Five, Dr. Mutulu Shakur, Russell Schultz, or, for that matter, Chelsea, formerly known as Bradley Manning, or the released Len Stewart? Dennis, an alleged U.S. citizen, can go anywhere he wants, and he should be able to do that without the harassment of a corporate sensationalist press. Amiri Baraka, Poet on Fire, 1934-2014. The name Amiri Baraka has been known to me since my teens, when I was a member of the Black Panther Party. His name was often linked with that of Dr. Maulana Karenga, credited with founding Kwanzaa celebrations, of the LA-based US organization, which began as competition with the Black Panthers for influence in Black LA, and devolved into a deadly feud between enemies, aided and abetted by the maliciousness of the FBI. But Baraka posed an intriguing figure, for he radiated both love and rage funneled through his poems, which pulsated with revolutionary fire. He was born in 1934 in Newark, New Jersey, as Everett Leroy Jones, and became a rising star of the Beat era in the East Village, New York. When he joined the U.S. Air Force, he found a revelation in books while traveling in Chicago. He saw a bookstore with a green door called The Green Door, and within, he had an epiphany. In his 1984 biography, he wrote, "Something dawned on me, like a big light bulb over my noggin. The comic strip idea lit up my mind at that moment as I stared at the books. I suddenly understood that I didn't know a hell of a lot about anything. What it was that seemed to move me then was that learning was important. I'd never thought that before." That moment spurred him to seriously read, study, and enlarge his understanding, not for a grade, but for the simple joy of learning. He gorged himself on books, on all kinds of books, poetry, history, statistics, and beyond. In July 1960, he would hit another turning point. He went to Cuba. In his 1966 essay, Cuba Libre, he recounts his reaction to harsh criticisms of the U.S. empire, saying, "I'm a poet. What can I do? I write, that's all. I'm not even interested in politics." A Mexican poet, Jaime Shelley, responded acidly, "You want to cultivate your soul? In the ugliness you live in, you want to cultivate your soul? Well, we've got millions of starving people to feed, and that moves me enough to make poems out of." That trip radicalized him and his poetry and spurred him on to black cultural nationalism, revolutionary nationalism, Marxism, and the building of black community organizations. The impacts of learning and Cuba kept him seeking the right synthesis of revolutionary politics to transform society. Although lesser known, he was a music critic of considerable insight. His love of jazz was deep, even spiritual, but he also loved R&B, gospels, and blues as cultural expressions of various stages of black life. He also dug rap, it being at bottom poetry, but he condemned the corporate control over its production and distribution. Of rap, he wrote, "That's why rap delighted me so, and still does, even though now it's been widely co-opted by Uncle Bubba and the Mind Bandits, because I could see that some of what came out of us had taken root in open, popular, mass-based poetry. It arrived. That's why the corporations moved so swiftly to cover and co-opt, why they disappeared Grandmaster Flash and Africa Bambaataa, accused Prof. Griff of the Big AS, and brought in flesh rap like Two Live Crew. Gangster rap was also brought in to exchange political agitation with ignorant braggadocio and thuggish imbecility, justifying the state nigger youth annihilation program." Amiri Baraka and his wife Amina were good friends of MOVE's Pam Africa and spent time together when she was in Newark. But Baraka put his best self in his poems, which revealed his wit and his anger. In his 1979 poem, In the Tradition, he had a line that said it all. "Nigger music's almost all you got, and you find it much too hot." Amiri Baraka was 79. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.